Welcome to Capital Connections. This week, the topics of discussion from the Montana legislature, a local option tax proposal, and then sentencing reform in the state's criminal justice system. I'm Jackie Yamanaka. I want to welcome Senator Mike Phillips of Bozeman for coming in and talking about this idea of a local option sales tax that would provide funding for infrastructure and property tax relief. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, Jackie, it's certainly my pleasure. This is a most pressing idea that will, I believe, provide Montana a long-term solution to be more self-reliant and more able to address our pressing infrastructure, roads, sewers, other water systems, those needs going forward. It, in my estimation, is one of the most important bills of the session.
Let's back up here because we want to make sure people understand this issue before we kind of talk about the mechanics. What is a local option sales tax?
Sure. The way this bill is set up, and we haven't introduced it yet, we're
still in LC.
We're moving it forward day by day, step by step. But it's a simple concept. It would say that local folks from the city of Bozeman, for example, would have the opportunity to vote on imposing a tax on the purchase of certain items so that new revenue was generated, new money was collected, and that money then could be used for certain things. But here's where things get specific. You get to vote on a tax. The tax can be no more than 4% of the purchase of luxury items, items that are typically bought by visitors to the state. It would be a tax on prepared food, for example, a tax on drinks that you'd buy at a bar, for example. No more than 4%. And then money raised, if you said yes, and the majority of voters in the jurisdiction, the city of Bozeman, for example, said yes, then it would also indicate we're going to take a specific amount of the money raised for property tax relief. It might be 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%.
For that jurisdiction.
The voters would say, we want to raise new money. We're going to raise a dollar. We're going to raise a dollar, and we're going to take 30% of that dollar, and we're going to give it to Class 4, principally homeowners, to reduce property taxes, leaving 60 cents of that dollar for specifically defined infrastructure projects, fixing a road, for example. The tax would remain in place until that particular project was done, and then the tax would go away. So the beauty of this idea, it doesn't rely on Helena, doesn't send money to Helena. There's no arm wrestling over the money. It stays in the local community. There's a specific tax amount. You get to vote on it. 1%, 2% can be no more than 4. A specific amount has to go to property tax relief. At least 10% is the minimum mark. It might increase to something more as the minimum, but a minimum doesn't mean that's what it has to be. You might choose as a voter to set it higher. And then when the project that's identified is done, the tax goes away. Here's an approach that's independent of Helen that has a decided beginning, a middle, and an end to address critical needs, property tax relief and infrastructure maintenance and establishment. And the beauty, it's absolutely independent of Helen.
And I just want to point out, I mean, not speaking as someone who has any so-called the proverbial dog in the fight, this is not a new idea because there are several communities in our region, and I'm just going to name, for example, West Yellowstone,
sure,
and Red Lodge, that have a so-called resort tax, which is basically what this idea is based on. Mm-hmm. But what's different, I mean, and you just talked about it, this is not an ongoing idea,
no,
necessarily.
No, Jackie, this is not. If you stand in opposition to the perpetual growth of government, you got to love this idea. Because by design, it stands in opposition to perpetual growth. The tax is imposed, the project is completed, the tax goes away. It is a beautifully simple idea. It focuses on the power of local communities to know best how to navigate their future. It sets our communities independent from Helena. You know, when you look at what happens in Helena, there's a whole bunch of projects that are brought to Helena, and people come here and argue for and against, and there's a lot of politicking that goes on, and there's a lot of arm wrestling that goes on. And some communities, Bozeman, for example, the community I'm blessed to live in, and honored to serve. Bozeman has the means to be increasingly self-reliant. And by it becoming self-reliant, you know what it does, Jackie? It inevitably begins to divorce itself from Helena, which means that other communities that aren't so situated to be so self-reliant have less competition in Helena. I recognize that, just as an example, Weebo, Montana, doesn't have the same economic capacity as Bozeman, Montana. Well, fair enough. Weebo still has real needs. Why not give Weebo better access to general fund money, the money we all contribute to the state of Montana through our taxes that the legislature decides on, give them better access by saying to Bozeman, we need you to carry your own water. Bozeman, you have the means to do that. This local option tax is a way to do just that. If you believe that both parties, Democrat, Republican, they have a basic architecture that guides their political service. And both parties would have you believe a pillar of their architecture, a pillar of their paradigm guiding political service is drive decisions to a local level whenever possible. Well, holy mackerel. How then can you stand in opposition to this when it's driving the decision to a local level? And it's designed so simply there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. Nobody gets surprised. You're not counting on your city commissioners to make good choices. You're doing the job. So here's the rub. You know what people say they're going to vote against this bill? They say, "Well, gee whiz, you know there'll be electoral consequences. I'll go home and my neighbors say you voted for a tax." And I say, "Wait a minute."
And a sales tax. I mean, because it'll be branded as
right.
A sales tax.
But Jackie, I go home and I would say to my neighbor, "I didn't vote for a sales tax. I voted to have faith in you. You voted to have faith in me. You voted me to go to Helena. I voted to have faith in you. You need to engage if you're going to expect benefits from public money, tax money.
Now,
you've got to accept responsibility for voting yes or no."
Now, I live in Yellowstone County, for example. You live in Bozeman.
Yeah.
Do you think I know how which streets have the most potholes in Bozeman? I mean, this is basically what you're saying. It's
yes,
it's
right.
your voters in the city of Bozeman are saying,
sure.
This water system needs fixing. These potholes need fixing. Our bridge is falling down here.
Yeah.
No. Am I reading it right versus, say, someone like me from Yellowstone County?
Jackie, you understand the basic approach perfectly. It's all about saying to local folks, you need to engage. It's your community. You know it best. What do you want to be in the future? Stop looking to Helena to make all of these tough decisions, especially if you're a community that has capacity to promote self-reliance. This bill has little relevance to many communities in Montana. They could choose to vote for it. A county could choose, a petroleum county could choose to do this. They probably won't. Okay.
But they could.
Well, they could. Gallatin County, in contrast, may well see value in doing this so that they can invest in themselves. This really, truly is about having faith in local folks to make good decisions that move their community and then secondarily Montana forward. And here's a very important point. When you look at how we pay for Montana's future, we typically are taxing things that have uncertain futures. For example, do you know, Jackie, that for the next 30 years, we are dedicating, for all intent and purposes, $1 billion of coal money to Montana's public employee retirement system. $1 billion over the next 30 years. It has to be paid, and we're going to use coal tax money to pay it. No matter who you are, if you're paying attention, you have to accept the fact that coal has a somewhat uncertain future. So we've built this absolutely certain need, investing in the retirement system, against an uncertain asset.
Well, that's exactly why I wanted to, next question, because you're looking at luxury goods, rental cars, motel, hotel rooms, and this is exactly what you're getting to. You're talking about the tourists.
That's correct.
Those from out of state.
That's correct. Thank you.
But still recognizing that, Montanans travel to Bozeman for, say, a state basketball tournament. They travel to Billings. They travel to Missoula, for example.
Yeah.
But still, that is really what you're getting at. It's this untapped resource.
Jackie, it's mostly, if the bill passes, it will mostly be a tax that's paid for by visitors to the state, and they, I think, will willingly, proudly pay to help Montana have a great future because we've addressed infrastructure needs. But I want to go back to that coal. So $1 billion of coal. We've made these promises on a stream of revenue that's somewhat uncertain. In contrast, you know, there's an economic sector in Montana that's about $4 billion big every year. An economic sector that's about $4 billion to the good every year that we principally do not touch. And, of course, that's the tourist sector. Visitors to the state largely come and go with no opportunity to invest in our future. This particular bill would say to them, because you tend to be the ones buying these luxury items, you're going to pay this up to 4% tax, and we're going to take your money and use it per the directions provided by local voters to generate property tax relief, at least 10%, but it could be much, much more. And whatever's left is going to go to specific infrastructure projects that have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and when the end is reached, the tax goes away.
I have to ask you before we run out of time. You're a Democrat. This is a Republican-controlled legislature. How much, I guess, does the future of this bill moving through session and maybe landing on the governor's desk depend on Republicans signing on and becoming co-sponsors?
Yeah, you know, Jackie, the bill technically hasn't been introduced yet. I happen to be the one that's still willing to do some of the legwork to move it forward. I may not be the final sponsor. I'm smart enough to realize sometimes a great message can be messed up by the wrong messenger. There's no doubt that this bill has more likelihood of passing if it's got a Republican sponsor. I would willingly, gladly, proudly step out of the way. I just want to help. It is a certainty, more generally, that this bill probably will not pass without a close to a majority of Republicans being in the majority of the vote. So what does that mean? In the Senate, for a bill to pass, we got to get 26 votes. 26, okay. This bill doesn't pass without 10, 12, 13 Republicans.
I don't think Democrats will pass it on their own, frankly.
Well, we don't have the numbers.
The numbers. And also, it could be branded as a sales tax.
Sure.
And if this litmus test of purity stains any discussion on a local option tax, you're going to need a coalition of both Democrats and Republicans. I mean, I could be wrong.
No, Jackie, you're stitching together exactly the argument of opposition that I've heard over and over again. And I keep saying, wait a minute. You're not voting for a sales tax. You're not. You're voting to give local folks the chance to engage. You have so little faith in your neighbors that they can't get that? You have so little faith in your neighbors that they don't know when to vote yes or no? For heaven's sakes, they sent you here. Am I to question your presence here because your voters are knuckleheads? Now, when you put it that way, they say, oh, no, I'm not saying that. And I said, well, wait a minute. Then you mean to tell me you think you're going to be haunted back home by the notion that you voted for a sales tax when, in fact, you didn't? What you did was vote to give them the opportunity to shine.
Right. Thank you so much,
Senator
Mike Phillips of Bozeman.
My treat. Thank you.
I want to welcome Senator Cynthia Wolken, an attorney from Missoula, who also chaired during the interim the Commission on Sentencing. And there are about a half a dozen or so bills to reform sentencing in Montana. You led that huge effort. I want to give you an opportunity to remind our listeners, what was your charge during the interim?
Well, thank you, Jackie, for having me on. And yes, it was a pleasure to chair the Commission on Sentencing, which, you know, the legislature has certain committees that meet regularly in between our legislative sessions. But this committee, the Sentencing Commission, was actually a special commission. The last time Montana had one was in 1996. And every session we pass, you know, a few bills that deal with the criminal justice system. Maybe we create a new crime or enhance a penalty or do something, but we never really step back and take the 30,000-foot view of what we're actually doing and the effects of our legislation on the criminal justice system. And so out of necessity, because the budgets of our public safety agencies are just growing exponentially, particularly in the Department of Corrections, we wanted to take a look at, what are we doing? Why is our system dysfunctional? Why is it so expensive and doesn't seem to be working as planned? And so that's what the Sentencing Commission did, and 12 bills actually came out of that, and they're moving through the process. And I think as a package that we're really going to see, if they do end up passing the legislature, we're going to see some really significant improvements in our criminal justice system that will not only improve public safety, which is the ultimate goal, but save taxpayers money and just make things work a little easier for our counties and cities.
What did the commission, and perhaps you in particular as chair, as identify among those dozen bills, kind of the key measures or ways to get at what you just described?
Well, we found that there were three main areas that we were having trouble with. First are the jails. Our county jails are full. They're full with their own inmates, and because of the state issues, they're backed up with state inmates. So the high cost of our county jail system to the state was one main issue we wanted to solve. Secondly, index crimes in Montana are stable and relatively low regionally, and those crimes are violent sexual crimes, the ones that really worry us. So we actually haven't seen a spike in those. So Montana is relatively safe, but we have this revolving door of people who keep returning. Recidivism is the technical term. People who continue to return. So maybe they get probation for a felony, and they, for whatever reason, they're not successful, and then they end up going to prison for maybe a technical violation, and then they come back out, get another probationary term or whatever it is, and then can't hack it and go back to prison. We want to stop this revolving door. And then closely related to the revolving door is Montana's the growing impact of substance abuse, particularly meth and opiates, and the expense that's causing all across our state agencies. You know, that we have a record number of children in foster care, jails and prisons are full, our courts, our cases are at capacity. So how do we address substance abuse early on so that people can get help without being cycled further through the system? And then ultimately, pretty much the most expensive thing we can do as a state is incarcerate somebody in prison. It's over $40,000 a year to do that. So the whole idea behind these bills was to figure out how we can spend our money more wisely up front to save costs in the back end.
Okay. And then, of course, the County Attorneys Association, one of their concerns has been, as you mentioned earlier, the public safety aspect. How do you hold people accountable for their actions if they do commit a crime, are convicted, so they're charged with a crime, convicted, and so forth, and then if they get sentenced to probation, parole, somewhere in that process, and then they fall out, how do you keep folks accountable as a part of public safety?
Sure. And I think so many of our bills are designed to do that. One in particular is designed to I guess I should back up and say that we had the expertise of, through this process, the Council of State Governments Public Safety Center and or Justice Center, and they're experts in criminal justice systems. They have worked in, I think, 15 other states. So we're not reinventing the wheel. They know how to come in and sort of analyze the system and make policy recommendations that will not jeopardize public safety. One of the bills that we have is based on our what we know about best practices, which is if people are going to mess up on probation, they usually do it within the first 6 months. And so it really doesn't make a lot of sense to keep somebody who maybe they have a felony, first-time offense, possession of dangerous drugs. So maybe they are on probation, to keep that person on probation for, you know, 10 years for something like that, or it just doesn't make a lot of sense. Of course, if somebody commits another crime after they're off probation, they can always be charged with that crime. But we wanted to get that person resources up front and make sure that we can have them be successful in getting back on their feet, you know, maintaining employment and all of the things that we like to see early on. So focusing resources early on when they can make the most difference and saving jail beds and prison beds for people who really need to be there. And I do want to say that other states that have taken this approach have had have been wildly successful. We had North Carolina. We heard that they had done some similar changes to their probation system, and you know their crime rate actually went down. And Idaho recently undertook justice reinvestment, and I think for the first time ever, their Department of Corrections returned money to the general fund. So these are proven ways of improving our system, and I know, you know, we'll never have everybody on board. And I'll note that in those states, I don't think any state that did justice reinvestment had, you know, the County Attorney Association supporting them. And I very much respect them, but I feel that that nothing in this bill package jeopardizes public safety. In fact, I think it's aimed at reducing recidivism. So we don't want more victims. We want people to get healthy, get better, and get on with their lives.
And also, one of the bills, if I'm remembering correctly, does increase the amount of probation and parole officials. Is that correct?
Yes.
To help supervise. I've heard anecdotally out in the field that sometimes local probation and parole officers are so overwhelmed, they really can't get a good gauge on who they are supervising.
That's exactly right, Jackie. And we need to really let them, you know, have a manageable caseload so that they can check in with somebody. Maybe somebody needs to be checked in with twice a week or three times a week rather than, you know, once a month because their caseloads are so high. And looking at that fiscally, you just really see, I mean, if one of their probationers doesn't get that intense supervision and messes up, they're going back to a $40,000 prison bed. So really, fiscally, it makes sense.
You mentioned drug abuse. Certainly Montana, like many other states, are using treatment courts. There is the WATCH program, for example, for those who need more intense supervision. But certainly the treatment court option, whether it's drug court or mental health court or veterans court, I mean, family court, we can go on and on. What role do you see those treatment courts playing in this overall scheme of reforming sentencing?
Well, Jackie, I think they're very important because they take a holistic approach, and you can't just use the stick all the time. We have evidence that, yes, the stick works, but for every time there's a disincentive for somebody, there should be rewards along the way. And treatment courts do a really good job at getting to root causes of why people use substances, and a lot of them, as you mentioned, deal with people that have mental illness and alcoholism, or maybe they're veterans and they're struggling with alcoholism. So they really try to figure out why is this person in the system? What can we do to support them? And they play a really important role in diverting people from prisons.
I have to ask also, because when you do warehouse someone in a correctional facility and then they get out, oftentimes they have problems, and it might be a condition of probation and parole, of getting a job, finding a house, rebuilding their lives. These bills also work toward that. How do you take an individual so you don't get that recidivism, that they have to return to dealing drugs or whatever it is just in order to survive?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, reentry is really huge. If people, you know, are unable to find jobs and housing, those are two indications that person's going to likely return to prison. These are already people who might not have the family ties they had going in for obvious reasons. And And if we don't allow our probation and parole department, give them the resources to really help that person with the whole host of things they might need, like health insurance, housing, a job, having rebuilding community supports, either familial or non-familial, those things are so important. And we, in the sentencing commission, there has been work on reentry over the past 5 or 7 years in Montana, but really the crux of it is housing. A lot of them, one of our bills addresses housing and helps them access that. On any given day, we have about 130 people that have been paroled in the prison system. So the parole board has determined they're not a risk to public safety, but they're sitting in a prison bed, probably the most expensive public housing that we have in Montana, that costs about $3,600 a month to the taxpayer, and they're just sitting there because there's no, it's very hard to be a felon and call from Deer Lodge to a property management company or a landlord and have a positive reaction about renting a property. So we have to address that really from a fiscal perspective and from a public safety perspective, because again, we want to make sure PNP officers know where their clients are. It's very risky to have a felon who we don't know where they are. They have nowhere to live. So that's a part of this mix.
And I want to bring up the County Attorneys Association, because they have questioned the work of the commission and your claims that this eventually will save taxpayer dollars. And they'll point to me and say, look at the fiscal notes. Look at the fiscal notes. The results are zero, or it's going to cost money in some cases. Is this a matter of maybe where Montana won't see immediate savings, but it's more of a gradual, as I guess if the goal is to reduce the amount of backlog at Deer Lodge or the women's prison and, frankly, county jails?
So, well, thank you for the question. And the Council of State Governments, they're, again, experts in this area, and they've done a fiscal impact for us, and it's actually, I think, a pretty conservative fiscal impact. So their assessment is that unless we take action, that Montana's prison population is forecasted to increase 14% in the next 6 years, and that by undertaking this, passing this package of bills, that we can avert $69 million in spending on new prison beds. So that's, growing our facilities that we already have. And that not just in the $69 million averted costs, that we'd also have a net savings of $48 million in recidivism over the same period of time. And again, I think these are very conservative estimates of the savings and aversions that we'll see. I will note that I'm asking for about $1.5 million for the Sentencing Commission bills. So even if we see, less than what's projected, this just pays for itself multiple times over. And again, these are based on, they have statisticians and fiscal analysts on staff with them and have done this in other states. So I really rely on them, and I believe that the savings are accurate.
Well, that will have to be the last word since we are out of time. I want to thank you very much, Senator Cynthia Wolken of Missoula, also an attorney, and she chaired the Commission on Sentencing.
You've been listening to Capital Connections. Thank you for joining me. I'm Jackie Yamanaka. You can find this and past programs, as well as links and other resources, on our website, ypradio.org. The Capital Connections theme music is courtesy of the Alex Nauman Trio. Capital Connections is a production of YPR News.